So it's another week in which conversations about mental health, specifically suicide, have been at the forefront of the news and national consciousness in the U.S. I am, of course, referring to the death of Kate Spade and the numerous articles and social media posts that are attempting to work through to explain how someone who from the outside was so successful and brilliant and creative came to the conclusion that she had no option but to end her life. This, of course, is a very difficult topic to wrestle with because none of us can get inside the head of someone who makes the decision to take their own life. It's a decision that's born out of deep depression, deep hopelessness, sometimes deep isolation and loneliness. For some people, it's impulsive. For some people, it's something that they've thought about for years. It's the kind of thing where it's very difficult to say, this is the one cause. If we can prevent this from happening, then we can eliminate the risk for suicide. If we can use this treatment or this intervention, then we'll be able to solve this problem. And unfortunately, there's no singular explanation, and therefore there's no singular cure. A couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to talk with Jeff Clark. Jeff is a psychiatrist who's finishing up his psychiatric residency in the state of Washington. He's also an entrepreneur, and he's a longtime friend of the show. Some of you might remember him from episode 137 when he and Carrie Dills talked about the life-sustaining magic of sleep. Well, Jeff is back on this week, and I think our conversation is really timely because we talked about some kind of nitty-gritty psychological, psychiatric topics like suicide, like what to do in a psychiatric emergency. And we talk a little bit about the use of medicine to treat mental illness. So I hope this is a good conversation for you. We've said it over and over on the show, but one of the central missions, if you will, of the Zen Founder podcast is to really promote open conversation about mental health and for you to feel more equipped to talk to your family, to your colleagues, to your team about how to stay mentally healthy, how to take care of yourselves and each other when mental health starts to break down, and how to be as preventative as possible to catch problems before they become huge problems, before they become life and death problems. So I am grateful for Jeff that he took the time to come on the podcast, and I hope that you enjoy this conversation and that it is one that's beneficial to you.
We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
That overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families. This is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
We know this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life.
Zen founder.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other would both get value from the episode.
Dr. Jeff Clark. Do you go by Jeff or Jeffrey?
Usually just Jeff.
Just Jeff,
I even try to drop the doctor with most of my patients and just go by Jeff.
I see. Why do you drop the doctor?
Oh, I suppose there's a little bit of internalized self-loathing there, but of the title of doctor, but I find there's enough distance between the doctor and patient already that breaking down the barrier and making it easier to talk one-on-one and establish a human connection really helps a lot of people. So I try to go without the doctor whenever possible.
Yeah, I think, and it's one of the reasons I'm so glad to be able to talk to you today, because I think there is a certain sort of mystique or mystery around mental health professionals, around doctors, around psychiatrists, and they can feel like sometimes otherworldly to folks who don't work in the kinds of fields that we work in.
Right. That's absolutely true. I, you know, in as part of my training, I worked in all sorts of different fields of medicine, and it's not uncommon to refer someone to a psychiatrist. And the reaction you get when that happens is pretty startling. And so it can be really welcoming, or it can be, I must think I'm crazy, or it can be anything. So I appreciate that the response can be varied.
What funny things have people said to you about your chosen field?
I remember my wife's grandfather, when she learned after going through all of medical school, I was going to specialize in psychiatry, she heard him say, "Oh, I thought he was going to be a real doctor."
That's me. I'm the not real doctor.
I think, you know, everybody's focused on trying to help people in the way they know best, and titles and the rest. Sometimes they're helpful, but a lot of times they get in the way.
Yeah. I think that psychiatry, psychology, mental health, as a field is particularly vulnerable to a lot of stigma and a lot of like apprehension about talking to a psychiatrist or a psychologist.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think that, you know, your desire to be approachable and just a really sort of real normal human helps break down some of those barriers. I think our audience will also be really interested to know that during the process of doing medical school and residency, you've been launching your own business, and you are also an entrepreneur in addition to being a physician.
Yeah, that's one of my passions. I fell in love with business before I started medical school, and have always wanted to find a way to be an entrepreneur. And I think like everyone else who goes through this, it's a journey, and I'm certainly on the lower rungs of the ladder than most of the people who listen to this podcast, but there's so much good you can do through business. And I really believe that some of the things we do in medicine just don't scale that well. And we need good entrepreneurs to figure out how to get this to more people. Hmm. So, you know, I feel grateful to be a small part of this community and to learn from other great founders.
Okay, hear that, guys. Dr. Jeff is one of us. He's an entrepreneur too. Yeah. So in my life as a therapist or in the consulting that I do with founders, one of the things that people are most apprehensive to talk about is medicine. And, you know, sure. I don't do a lot of conversation with people about medicine, but I definitely refer to psychiatrists often and say, you know what? Mm. We've been working at this in therapy for a while. And I think it's really worth a conversation with your physician about whether medicine might be helpful to you. Why do you think there's so much resistance around psychiatric medication?
You know, we have a complicated relationship with medicine. I think one of the best seminars I ever went to in residency was really talking about medicine as a full-blown relationship. Like you have a relationship to these pills just like you would with a friend or an acquaintance. And it's very real. It's very tangible. And when we're taking a medication that can alter our brain chemistry, it can make long-term changes, it comes with side effects, it comes with stigma, there's a lot going on there. And I try to be cognizant of that because everybody approaches medicine in a different way. Some people have had a family member that did really well on a medication and that gives them a positive initial response. And some people have someone who's really harmed by medication. And I think it's important to recognize that it's a complicated relationship, and that's okay.
Yeah. And I appreciate that sense of the complexity from you and from other mental health professionals that I've worked with, because I think we are talking about entities that are pretty powerful.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a saying that you're taught at the very beginning of medical school that anything strong enough to help you is strong enough to hurt you. And I think that's the case for every intervention. So medication is there's a common thread with medicine of you get side effects if you take too much. You can be really harmed if you take the wrong medication at the wrong time. But any kind of intervention you do has consequences. So a lot of people go through psychotherapy. I'm a beneficiary of good psychotherapy, and it changes your perspective. It changes your relationships, and not always just for the good. And so medication is no different. The biggest difference between medication is that the risks and the stakes tend to be a little bit higher when you take medication as mm-hmm. opposed to doing something like psychotherapy.
So I think maybe one of the most kind of common conversations I have is someone who's really struggling with some pretty significant depression and is at a point mm-hmm. where they're really not functioning super well in their business at this point and are really just kind of having trouble like getting started in the day. They're having trouble feeling any motivation. They feel either really numb or pretty sad. And it's lingering. Like it's lingering mm-hmm. beyond helpful tips from friends and things that they read online right. about what to do. And so that yeah. might be a point where I might say, hey, why don't you just make an appointment with your doctor or mm-hmm. get in with a psychiatrist and just have the conversation. But many, you know, like I said, sometimes people are pretty reticent to do that. How does that conversation go from your end?
Yeah. So when I think of depression and anxiety, I think of them as disorders that push us towards stasis. So when you're depressed, the things that will make you feel better in general, not always, are reaching out to connect with other people, doing things that you find pleasure in, doing things that you're good at and you feel mastery over. And when you're depressed, it's really hard to want to do these things. And so one of the most common psychotherapies for depression, which I know you're aware of, is behavioral activation, where you slowly try to help build those things into people's lives. But sometimes people come in, especially when they have more of a moderate or severe depression, and they just can't get out of the rut. Even the simplest suggestion is too much. And there's a tendency in our culture to shame people into thinking they're broken when they can't get out and do these things. But depression is tough. And sometimes you need a little bit of a boost to get out of the rut. And a medication can be a good place to start if you're really stuck.
And certainly something that often goes hand in hand with all those other things, with good therapy, with taking good care of yourself.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think sometimes people, I mean, obviously medicines are really powerful, but I think sometimes people think that, you know, the medicine is going to be the magic bullet. And, you know, as we've talked about, sometimes it's really a piece of a larger course of treatment or self-care.
Right. Yeah. I don't have a medication that will solve all of your problems. I do have some things that can help you, that can be supplements, essentially, that can get you out of the rut and start working on the things that will make you happy and bring you joy in life. But I think of medications as a supplement to a healthy life, not a replacement for all the other good things. When I start a medication, I start also focusing on sleep and diet and exercise, learning how to relax, working on relationships. And from my side, I'm always trying to talk people into going to see a therapist and work with them. And I think it's a common thread in mental health that you're always trying to get the whole team involved to help somebody, because it's pretty uncommon for someone to come to just one person and get all their needs met.
Yeah, absolutely. What are the experiences or diagnoses maybe where you feel like, okay, you definitely need to have a conversation with a psychiatrist about medication, where medication is maybe sort of a central component of treatment?
Sure. So there's this dictum that I think every psychologist and every psychiatrist learns in their training, that for most disorders, a combination of therapy and medication gets you the most mileage. But for some things, therapy alone works much better. So for example, insomnia, that's something you really want to treat with therapy, not medication. And on the medication side, problems like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, another common theme where medication really can be helpful is with certain substance use disorders. So if someone has problems with opiates like heroin, there's a lot of medications that can really help with that in a way that therapy sometimes can't touch. The other case that I think is pretty common among founders is with ADHD.
Oh yeah.
I have done my share of psychotherapy for ADHD, and it can be a nice supplement, but the data are very clear that medication makes the biggest difference when you're trying to treat ADHD.
So I've worked with lots of founders who have ADHD, and I know the, the research on this is still like maybe not completely conclusive, but I think we can maybe at least agree there's at least a trend of really smart folks who haven't necessarily done well in traditional employment or traditional educational venues who find their way to being founders and do super well.
And absolutely.
I think sometimes people are aware of how ADHD might be damaging their relationships, or there's some impulsivity that can create difficulty in the business, but are a little bit nervous about medication for ADHD because of their fear that that might sort of take away from their secret sauce. Or yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts about that? Do you always medicate ADHD? I mean, how do you think about that?
It's difficult, and there's no one rule. And a lot of the time, founders and people who have functioning at a very high level come to a psychiatrist much later in life and had never been diagnosed with ADHD in childhood. But if you look at the pattern, it's pretty clear that it's been there. It's difficult. We don't have clear clinical guidelines on what to do in these cases. I know some of my colleagues will say if they weren't treated with a stimulant as a child, they should never receive one as an adult. Many of us are much more open to considering that, but stimulant medications are highly controlled substances, and they require good follow-up, a lot of assessment. So that's the first part, is we got to make sure it's a good choice. The nice thing, though, is they're one of the few medications in psychiatry where we know it works quickly.
Right. Within 24
within days.
Hours. Yeah. 48. Yeah. Couple days. Yeah.
And so some people find it really helps them capitalize on their secret sauce. Other people find that it really distances them from their work. And so I try to have really close follow-up, make sure we're doing more good than harm. The other thing that often happens when we treat ADHD is anxiety can get a lot worse. And so the fears of running a team, having everything cave in on you, having it all fall apart, those really pop out sometimes when we start a stimulant. And so it's something I'm cautious about and watch really closely.
Yeah. What advice do you have for people in terms of how to be a good patient? So someone is maybe beginning an ADHD medicine or beginning a psychiatric medicine. Like, from your perspective, what helps a patient really get the most out of their relationship with you?
So it's a good question. I'm a little bit hesitant about the term good patient.
Okay. A collaborative patient.
Yeah.
Give me a different word. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, there's this idea within medicine, and we hear it a lot from colleagues outside of mental health, that someone who's struggling with anxiety or depression is often labeled as a difficult patient. And I think when you're entering mental health care, you need to focus less on pleasing the person in front of you and really trying to communicate what your needs are and what you want met. It's a place where you can open up. You can talk about really difficult struggles that you might not talk about somewhere else, challenges with relationships, with drugs, with really anything. And it ideally is a place that is non-judgmental. But if you really want to get the most out of it, one of the keys is to really open up and talk about what's going on. So when I prescribe a medication, I try to be as open as possible with my patients about what might happen and let them know that I want to hear about it. So with antidepressants, about 1 in 3 men get sexual side effects, and probably the same number of women. We don't have the same amount of data, but I tell them that right away to let them know this is all on the table.
Like we can talk about your sex life. It's cool.
Right.
It's important.
Absolutely. If it's messing things up, I want to know, because we can fix that. We can overcome it. But if you don't tell me, I can't help you.
Yeah.
And so side effects are key. Like, really bring up what is going on when you take this medication. And if your doctor doesn't take you seriously, find a different doctor. You want someone who takes you really seriously.
Yeah. And that's kind of my next question is what guidance do you have for people who are, they think they might want to talk to someone, but they have an appointment with someone who they don't like, or they don't feel connected to? What are your strategies for finding a good psychiatrist?
It can be tough. And I think it's especially tough in the United States, where healthcare is very fragmented and mental health care can be hard to come by. Most people in the United States get medications from a primary care physician, and that's often the best place to start. A good primary care doctor will know the basics of how to treat depression or anxiety. They'll often have a good therapist they can refer to, and many of them will consult with psychiatrists when they don't know, or can refer you on to a psychiatrist. The sad reality is, for most people, finding the right psychiatrist starts with going to your insurance's website and seeing who is covered, trying to find somebody on your plan. In some big cities, there are lots of good psychiatrists and therapists in private practice who take cash only. And so that can be a temporary stopgap if you need to get a second opinion. Some will be on a sliding scale. And I know in the early stages of starting a company, that may be all you can find. But like most challenges in running a business, it's the effort you put into solving the problem that's going to yield the results you need. And so the most important advice is, don't give up if you don't find the right person right away. Keep looking, keep asking questions, and keep going until you find somebody.
Keep working on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really a challenge. I know lots of founders I think we're all supposed to have health insurance at this point, but are either paying out of pocket for sort of creative tape together plans, or
absolutely,
have pretty limited coverage. And another resource that I found to be helpful, if you live in a place where there's a medical school, often medical schools have clinics where you'd see a resident who's hopefully well supervised by someone who they have access to resources and help. So that can be a lower fee, generally fairly high quality place to get care to. That's
definitely
a bit of an area. One of the things that I again, often end up talking with people about is just to transition a little bit away from the conversation about medicine, mm-hmm. but is self-sabotage, self-harm, the things that we do that get in our own way, or the ways mm-hmm. that we kind of act out our pain that can be kind of scary, where we scare ourselves, I guess, is one way to talk about that. You want to say a little bit about the topic of self-harm, what that means and how you see it?
Yeah, self-harm is, it's such a common problem. And a lot of times if you talk with mental health professionals, when they say self-harm, they mean somebody cutting or burning themselves. But I like to think of it in a much broader sense, that all of us choose to do things that benefit us in the short term, but in the long term may cause problems. So some of the most common examples are things like binge drinking or overeating, excessive risk taking. And some of these activities may be a really deep part of our identity. I know for a lot of entrepreneurs, their sense of risk is very high and it's mm-hmm. something they enjoy. And I don't want to take that away, but I do want to find ways to channel it so that we minimize any potential harms that might occur.
So I often will talk with people about self-sabotage, like, again, things sure. that we're doing that kind of aren't really in our best interest in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we cross over into the more clinical realm, we use the term self-harm. But I've found, and I think there's some research to support this, that like many, many people have thoughts about hurting themselves or even thoughts about mm-hmm. taking their lives, you know, that those are thoughts that are not so fringe in the human experience.
Absolutely. And I think if there's one thing I tell most of my patients, it's that a lot of people are walking around with thoughts of self-harm, thoughts that, you know, maybe it would be better if I weren't around. And it can be comforting to know you're not alone in thinking that. I think just about everybody has that thought at some time in their life, and many people walk around with it every day. So it's, life is hard.
Yeah.
And it's, there's a lot of reasons why we're wired this way and why we have to deal with this.
Yeah. I think in founders, especially, there's such an all-in investment in mm-hmm. building this business or building this vision of their lives. And it can, I think in people who tend toward a little bit of rigidity in their thinking, it feels like all or nothing, like I've got to make this work or there's not really an alternative for me. I can't imagine a different kind of life.
Yeah. You know, that's something I hear a lot. You know, one of the things that a good therapist can help with is really trying to introduce some flexibility into those thoughts. Because when you're feeling down or depressed or your back is against the wall, it can be a really dark place and it's hard to see alternatives. You know, a good therapist can help walk you through that and realize, well, let's see what would happen if your business failed. Let's walk through what would happen if you didn't make this fail. And most of the time, there are options. There is a way around it. When it's tough, you can't see that. And you really need the support of other people to help you get through it.
Which is, I think, one reason why it's helpful to put out there, like, hey, these pretty scary thoughts that can feel really, really dark, they're not that unusual. And if you talk to a doctor or to a therapist about them, like, they're not going to freak out. Like, they're not going to put you on the bus to the funny farm. Like, these are things that it's right. our job to talk through with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing I often say to patients when they're disclosing thoughts of suicide for the first time is how grateful I am that they're bringing it up, how courageous they're being. And I reassure them that my job is to help them yeah. in any way possible. And in the vast, vast majority of cases, I never send anyone to the hospital. And I try to support them and get them through it as an outpatient and together. There are rare cases when people really do need to be in the hospital for a short period of time,
mm-hmm.
but they're rare. And the impulse to want to hurt yourself or the feeling that you want out of the situation, but don't necessarily want to hurt yourself right now is very common.
Yeah.
Very, very common.
And the rare instances when it becomes an emergency, that's because someone's life is really in danger. And, you know, every once in a while, we do need to hospitalize somebody, but it's, again, it's super, mm-hmm. super rare. And it's really because we're really, really worried about their safety.
Absolutely. And I think something else that is often helpful is just describing what a psychiatric hospital is like. They are not places people go for months. In general, the average stay is 3 to 7 days. The goal is only stabilization. And usually we try to help people get out as soon as possible. I think another piece of it is really addressing what a mental health emergency looks like. Because like we've talked about, a lot of people walk around with these thoughts. And, you know, if you're dealing with those thoughts, I think that's a good sign that you need to seek out some help and find a good therapist or a good psychiatrist to work with. But an emergency is different. It's when the thoughts progress. So there's some warning signs you can think of. And the biggest warning sign is, has there been a sudden change in your thoughts or behaviors? So if you've been thinking passively, you know, I wish I didn't have to deal with this for a long time. And suddenly you start thinking, you know, I think I might want to end my life. Or you start coming up with plans or searching online for different ways to end your life. That's serious. Yeah. That's when I start getting worried. If you come into my office, the odds are still pretty low that you're going to go to the hospital, but it's definitely time to get help right away.
Mm-hmm. I often have people ask me about how they can support other people who are having these kinds of thoughts. So whether that's someone on their team or a co-founder or somebody who seems to really be declining or not be doing well, what strategies or advice do you use in that situation where, you know, it's maybe not necessarily me, but it's my friend or my co-founder who is just seems really not well.
This can be one of the hardest things imaginable. it's so difficult when you watch someone else suffer and you don't have control. it's challenging. I think the most important thing you can do is be there for them and express empathy, that you care. If they're making statements about despair or suicide, you know, really ask them about that. Mm-hmm. See what they're going through. Show them you care by really digging into it, and recommend that they get help. There are also resources you can reach out to get advice on what to do in that moment. So there are crisis hotlines. And if things are so bad that you're worried that something's going to happen that day, don't hesitate to call 911. Like if you know that somebody has a fifth of vodka and a gun and they're headed out of work or headed out of town, you know, that's the time to act, and it will disrupt the relationship. I don't want to say things will be rainbows and butterflies. It will.
Like they're probably going to be mad at you, but
they will be pissed.
As long as they're around to be mad, I think that's a trade most of us will make.
Right. Can't repair a relationship once somebody's gone.
Yeah.
And so I tend to lean towards caution. And it's something I've done with several of my patients. I haven't had to do it with a friend or a coworker yet, but the relationship is hard after you make that call, and then it gets better and you work through it. And if you show that you care and you support somebody and you care enough to give a damn about their life, mm-hmm. what's better than that?
Yeah. And I think sometimes people feel stuck on what to say or what to do in those moments. And I guess when all else fails, just being honest and saying, like, I'm really worried about you. I want you to be okay. I feel like we need more help than I can provide. And so I'm making this phone call. And again, it's hard to be super pissed at people for loving you a lot. Maybe in the moment they won't like it. Like over the long run, I think generally that comes across that when you're caring about someone and intervening on their behalf, that they get that.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. It's hard. There's no easy way around it, but caring matters. We have this idea in mental health of a suicide safety plan that a mental health practitioner will make with someone. And one of the common components of that plan is, who would you call in the event of a crisis? And I've had many people say to me, if I'm feeling suicidal, I'm not going to call someone because they're not going to be able to talk me out of it. I'll just do it. And the goal is not to have someone talk you out of it. The goal is to invite someone else into your suffering, to let them experience what you're experiencing and care with you, because that matters. As a mental health professional, I don't know how to talk someone out of it when they're on the brink, but I know how to express care. I know how to come up with a plan for today on what to do.
I know how to stall.
Right.
To a lot of what we do. Like, let's just sit still and wait a little while. See if this intensity of this feeling passes a little bit.
Right.
And that's sometimes good friendship. Like, let's Netflix and chill for the weekend and we'll revisit suicide on Monday. Just wait it out.
Yeah. And I've heard so many cases where that made all the difference in someone's life.
Yeah. You know, you're a physician, you take care of people who have their own mental health struggles, and you're also a founder. How has the founder life been for you? Have you had your own moments of, I don't know, feeling discouraged? Or, I feel like the ups and downs of what it's like to be an entrepreneur are pretty universal. Has that been part of your experience as well?
Absolutely. I sometimes feel ashamed to call myself an entrepreneur just because of how much farther I have to go. And there's moments when something goes well, when you're making sales, when you're getting the press you want and it's fantastic. And the other 90% of the time you have your nose to the grind and you're asking people to act when they may not be willing, or you're trying to make relationships that don't usually come through. You're running advertising campaigns that only work sometimes, and it's tough. And I strongly recommend against going it alone. Even if you're a solo founder, you need a community. You need people that will help you along the way, will let you know what's normal, what's not, how to change to make it work, and just be able to sit with the emotions with you. Because part of the ride is the business and the other part is just dealing with what's inside. And I'm sure there's one or two founders out there who've done it without bumps, but for the other 99% of us, it's tough.
If those would come forward, I would like to interview them. The people who have done it without bumps, because I have yet to meet them.
Right, yeah. They may be just a myth.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so helpful and important to have someone like you who's hanging out in the founder community, because I do think that part of my mission in many of my interactions with other entrepreneurs is to be like, hey, look, I'm a psychologist and I'm not creepy or crazy. Like, you can talk to somebody like me and also somebody like you, that the conversation around medication or emergencies or self-harm is bread and butter of what you do and what you care about. And that none of that is scary or upsetting. And in fact, you can be quite helpful in helping people sort through the harder parts of life, the places where they reach the end of their own ability to cope by themselves. So
I really appreciate all the work you do for our community, Sherry. And I totally agree with the sentiment that people who work in mental health are usually just as normal as you, as anybody else, sometimes shockingly so. And I found that, you know, one of the reasons I became a psychiatrist is I was in medical school and it's hyper competitive and it's difficult and there's a lot of arrogance, and psychiatrists are no different, but I found it was the right balance. These are my people, just good people trying to make a difference. And I, you know, it's a privilege to collaborate with the mental health community.
Yeah. And again, those trickier conversations about sex and death and scary thoughts and drugs and alcohol and medicine, like, bring it. We like talking about that. So.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the challenges of our work is we talk about some things that are so intense that we have to leave them at work. I don't bring home a lot of what I do, even though some of it would make the most amazing cocktail party experiences, stories you could imagine. And I leave it all at work because it's supposed to be a safe, almost sacred place to talk about the hard things in life.
I think that's an appropriate word. Yeah. Well, thanks, Jeff. I really appreciate you taking the time. For folks who want to follow your work or learn more about Slumber Camp, where's the best place for them to stalk you on the internet?
Yeah, you can find me online at slumbercamp.co or shoot me an email, Jeff@slumbercamp.co. Always happy to help and chat with founders.
And you can hear more about Jeff's work on sleep, which is, of course, if you've been following Zen Founder, something that I talk about a lot and think is super, super, super important to people's ability to do their business well. He was a guest on episode 137, which was where he was interviewed by Carrie Dills. So check that out too, to hear more from Jeff and his wisdom and insights.
Oh, thank you, Sherry.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.